and welcome to That Gabby Roslin Podcast, part of the Acast Creator Network. This week, I'm joined by the brilliant and very funny Kerry Godliman, famous for both her stand-up and her acting. She took time out of a busy schedule while she's touring Bosch, which is running till November the 10th, to talk to me about everything. I absolutely loved her in Whitstable Pearl, which you can still watch on Acorn TV via Amazon Prime. Also, adult material on Channel 4 and Trigger Point. And the good news is that's coming back for season 2. And of course, we chatted all about Afterlife and Ricky Gervais. And she told me how people react to her in the street. She is a complete joy to be around, and she has proper funny bones. Don't forget, you can keep up to date by following and subscribing, please, to the podcast, where a new episode is released every Monday. Leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app, and whilst you're there, why not leave us a review? We love to hear your thoughts. Now, on with the show. Kerry Godliman, honestly, you have proper funny bones. You're one of those people that I've overindulged in you over the past couple of days.
Oh, that always freaks me out when people say that.
Oh, no, no, no.
You're like, oh, I hope I'm...
The family have sat and watched your live at the Apollo. I mean, everything.
Wow.
Proper funny bones. But here's something I want to ask you. Okay. When I was doing my research and I was listening and I was reading interviews, oh my God, can they not... How fast do people mention the person I'm not going to mention? Okay, I'm not going to mention him until the end.
Okay.
Because, well, it's like, hello, Kerry. It's when people say to me, oh, Gabby, nice to meet you. Did you ever shag Chris Evans? I go, hello, hello.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because you're often associated with one specific thing, and I've done lots of different
things. You've done loads.
Well.
So we're talking about you.
But it's lovely to hear you saying about the comedy thing, because I am often associated with making people cry. So it's kind of nice to be reminded that it was the other thing that I did before.
Oh, no, it's a funny thing. So you've made me laugh for a very long time.
Oh, that's...
And I've it's sort of sitting opposite you. I feel like I know you so well because your stand-up is very personal.
Yeah.
And it's always as if you're just talking to your best friend.
That's what I've always tried to nail, exactly that, is that I find if I get creatively stuck or I think, oh, I'm supposed to be this or one should be that, I just remind myself that all I need to capture is that I'm just talking to a friend. That's how I can make it work for me. And I can imagine my closest friends and trying to make them laugh, and then I can access something that... You know, we can get in the way of our own creativity quite often. And if I'm trying to sort of free it up, that's how I free it up. I go, well, how would I make her laugh, my mate?
That's, you know. So did you always do that? Were you like that as a child?
Yeah, comedy was always sort of something I loved, yeah. And I did like making people laugh. And sometimes that's not always appropriate. And as you grow up, you sort of realise you don't have to constantly try and make people laugh. It's a weird thing, isn't it, humour? Because it can also sometimes be irritating if people... It's a sort of superpower when it works, but actually it can be a burden when it's inappropriate. You know, that kind of like, oh, maybe some situations one shouldn't always go after the gag.
But should... So what are the situations you shouldn't? Because I'm the worst, you know, a beautiful, lovely friend of mine, when she died, before she died, she said, I know you're going to get the giggles at my funeral.
Oh, that's funny.
And I did.
Well, bizarrely. Yeah, well, that's a very specific situation, isn't it? Because often, you know, like when funerals and people have talked about that kind of situation, but I mean, like, it just plagues you through school. Like, every report was class clown, blah blah blah, you know. And then work, like proper jobs, or I could only describe as other proper jobs that weren't these kind of jobs, yeah, that I ended up making sort of performance my job. But when I had jobs or, you know, office jobs or whatever, and it's like people just don't want you to sit there dicking about all day, you know. Or yeah. I think the thing about comedy is often you're sort of might be the one saying, oh, look, the king's got no trousers on. And in some situations that's just not appropriate. They're like, the king's got trousers on, can you just meet your targets and go along with, you know, the facade of normality or whatever. And if you're constantly subverting it, it's irritating.
Do you know, it's so funny because I'm obviously never done stand-up, never would.
honestly, I would poo myself. That's it.
I did for the best part of the first sort of 5 to 7 years. Yeah, there would be frequent episodes. Not literal, but there's stage fright is not something anyone swerves. But, and often people say, I think I couldn't do it, or I'd be too scared to do it, or whatever. And you go, well, I was scared, but I just did it anyway.
That's amazing. So are you not a fearful person?
Yeah,
though?
No, I am a fearful person. But
you don't let it stop
me.
You?
No.
Oh, that's such no. That is a superpower.
Being scared is okay.
Yeah.
Just be scared and still do it.
Yeah, but I mean, when I was little, my whole thing was about making people laugh. Always at school.
It's such a lovely thing just to make people laugh. It's a lovely thing to be able to do.
But my report said the same thing. Yeah. It was just, could she stop?
And then sometimes there are moments in your life when you're like, I want to be taken seriously. And there's nothing more absurd than a clown screaming, take me seriously.
But making a living, okay, so not just a job, but a living out of being funny, that's quite a leap of faith.
Yeah.
To be the person that goes, you know, to push you over that edge. And all of your friends, all the lovely comedians, Rob Beckett, who I love him and known him since
great.
He was, well, he still is quite. but making that, okay, saying, right, I know I can make people laugh. I'm now going to step out there and get paid to make people laugh. That's quite a...
Well, the jump for me was staggered with other little mini decisions. So there were things that eased that
jump. Me through those.
Well, acting and drama school. So I always did drama. So performance was always something I did. And because I didn't really know how you became a comic, I sort of became an actor because that was a more legitimate thing. And I went to youth theatre and then I went to drama school. And then when I left drama school, I did get a bit of work, but not loads. And it is a bit of a tough job. And then you have to find other ways of paying the rent. So you're kind of sort of piecemealing bits of work together. And I used to do this thing called Forum Theatre, which is like a kind of training. It's kind of like corporate acting work, if you know what I mean. You like role play and stuff like that. And it's when you go into various work contexts and sort of train people or facilitate training programs in anything from bullying in the workplace to diversity recruitment and all these different areas of employment law or blah, blah, blah. And it was always you'd do bits of drama, so you'd have characters and stuff, but you'd come out through the fourth wall and you'd talk to the delegates, they were officially called, but in my head it was always the audience, and talk to them directly. So I kind of bridged that thing between acting and character and talking directly to the audience, and I was quite comfortable with it, and I found humor quite useful because obviously these situations are a bit dry, so obviously humor kind of loosens them up. So I was kind of getting closer to the sensation and physicality of stand-up. So I was sort of thinking, oh, you know, I know it's the daytime and these people are all sober, but if it was dark and they'd had a few drinks, that's stand-up comedy.
So that it came from you, your
Well, I was comfortable with standing on stage, talking directly as myself to an audience. I'd been doing a lot of it. And I kind of just, I think for a lot of people, just the physicality of doing that is alien to them. But it wasn't alien to me. I was doing it every day for a job. So I wasn't nervous about standing on stage with a microphone and talking directly to an audience.
So all of those drama students, I mean, so many friends of mine, after leaving drama college, they did the same.
Yeah,
that's exactly the same as you. And they actually loved it.
Yeah, I loved it.
Because it was performing.
Yeah, it was performing, you're doing something useful, you're making a connection, which is all the things you love about acting and drama anyway. You're taking characters and circumstances and situations and you're sort of experimenting with, you know, hypothetical situations. You're like, well, if we demonstrate this sort of behaviour, what sort of impact does that have on that? You know, you're kind of playing around with situations, which is what plays are.
So it's funny because I think of you as a comedian, even though I suppose I first saw you acting. But in my head, because I'm a super fan of your comedy, that to me you're one in the same.
Well, they merged after
the unmentionable. We're not mentioning him.
It did. They those two worlds came much closer together after I'd worked with
that person,
Mr. G.
Yes.
So I then found that my acting career obviously elevated and took off. Also, my stand up profile went up a bit around the same time. It all kind of moved up a gear around the same time. But I had been doing both for a long time, and acting wise, I'd had a bit on the bill, and I'd done a bog roll ad, and I'd just been kicking around for a long time, turning up on the odd thing, like a part on Miranda, and occasionally people still come up to me because they've been watching old Miranda, you know, reruns, and they're like, I saw your episode. So they all bobbed along for a long time, and then it all just sort of stepped up.
So when it stepped up for the unmentionable, was that
no, it's making did, it seem as if it's
when, I know. But when he listens, he'll be like, oh, what?
You say my name!
No, we're not saying your name. But when it did step up, the fame thing is strange, isn't it? Because suddenly you went from, like you say, parts in Miranda, parts in all sorts. I will talk about Trigger Point and all sorts. You were in
Whitstable Pearl.
Yes.
Yeah.
Loved that. So you were doing all of those other things, but suddenly it leapt up a gear.
Yeah.
And then, so I presume your stand-up went to a different level.
Absolutely,
as well.
Because also around that time, I started doing way more panel shows. Like, I'd always been a bit Taskmaster's a lovely, fun one, but I'd always been really scared of doing things like Mock the Week, or for a long time, I wasn't quite brave enough to do that. It's interesting you saying about nerves. I wasn't as nervous about stand up as I was about doing panel shows.
I'm not surprised. The whole lad mentality.
Yes, which I don't think's the case. Exactly. I don't think it's the case anymore. Yeah. And by the time I came around to doing it, I wasn't even the only woman on the show anymore. So I think a lot's changed in the world of
big time.
But I was nervous of that. But when I finally, when things lined up for it to be more possible, I was more confident about it. And so that kind of comedy elevation also boosted up because of Live at the Apollo, Mock the Week, these other things, Taskmaster, these other things coming up in tandem with the acting stuff sort of picking up. So it's always been quite nice because it's felt like I've got two jobs.
The seesaw that's absolutely balanced in
yes,
the middle.
Yes,
that's quite nice.
And now it feels a bit like they are sort of interconnected.
Let's pick on for one of them. Let's do Live at the Apollo. There's a routine you do. I'm not going to quote your routine back to you, but as a family, we love it, which is the one about choosing names.
Oh, God. You know, it's so funny that, because it really, I was talking about names only this weekend. It's a compelling topic, isn't it?
Oh, but it is. But it's so funny. And your line about chastity, it makes us all as a family. It just makes
such an old-fashioned notion, isn't it?
And your son, so did you really call your son Frank?
Yeah, he's called Frank, and it didn't occur to me it had double meaning.
I thought that was just the end gag.
He is one of the most Frank people I think I've ever met. He has lived up to his name.
So for people who don't know the routine, you talk about how you've got to be so careful.
Yes.
When you have a baby, choosing a name.
Yeah, because the name Grace might be ill-suited to your daughter. That might not fit.
She'll just walk into it. She'll be just a
galumphing oaf, I think is the phrase I use. Crashing into God, things and being inappropriate.
It's properly funny.
But I love that topic of names and naming. We went to Latitude Festival this year, and this comedian who I know, but he didn't know that he was chatting to my son, Frank. Frank was down the front at the comedy tent, and this comic started chatting to him, and he said, what's your name? And Frank said, Frank. And he said, where's your mum? And he just went, oh, mum's off elsewhere or whatever. And he went, what's your mum's name? And he went, Kerry. And he went, oh, that's a name that's not coming back, isn't it? It really tickled me. I thought, sod you. But it's true. Names go in and out of fashion.
They really do.
You know.
My eldest daughter, she always says, Mum, why did you get? We gave her a very different name.
Yeah,
and she goes, "Why did you do that?" I said, "Because people won't forget it." She goes, "Oh, okay." I hated my name growing up as well because my name means Gabby, somebody who talks a lot, and I never shut up.
Oh, I would have never made that association if you had.
Yeah, at school, that was in the report. Gosh. She never stops laughing and she never stops talking.
I've school reports, man. They're like early reviews, aren't they? You're like, how dare you?
They were so right. They were so right.
Same, mine, class clown.
There we go. You see, they know. Teachers know. So you're Live at the Apollos, which I love, and then Mock the Week, which you were on. I'm like, oh, it's bad of the BBC to get rid of that. That's just
It does seem a shame, especially because the show had evolved quite a lot from its early days. I mean, that early reputation of it being very competitive and male and blah blah blah. I think that was certainly true, but it really moved on.
There's a whole big petition going on.
Is there?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know
people don't want it to end. But let's talk about Taskmaster. You knew that's where I was weaving.
that's my absolute favourite.
Gosh, what
that.
A great show.
Yeah, it is.
And
a
you
great
won
show.
It.
I can't believe I won it. When it comes up, I always feel compelled to point out I won by 1 point. It
you,
wasn't
you
like
won, no, forget that. You won it.
I won it. But it was
it the best one to do? Because Alex, I love
it. Yeah,
love
Alex's Alex. Brain is a wonderful place. It's just what goes on in there and the stuff he comes up with is extraordinary, really, isn't it? That he can come up with those tasks. It's so creative and playful.
He is. He's very, very clever and so lovely. Such a nice guy. But it's funny that, so the unmentionable one and Taskmaster. So the unmentionable one is first. And there was a couple of interviews with the unmentionable man where it's as if you weren't even in the, I was getting so frustrated. Because she's there. She's sitting. Stop talking to the unmentionable and talk to her. But also then the next thing is Taskmaster.
Yeah.
It's like, hello, I have a whole life.
Yes, a whole other career and
apart.
Yeah, load
that.
Of work. Yeah.
So when you go for auditions now, or maybe you don't need to.
Oh, 100% need to.
Oh, you still?
Well,
do.
It's self-tapes now since possibly the lockdown. I think now the going in for auditions is sort of pretty much
okay, so
fizzled out. Yeah, self-taping.
I was showing my age there.
No, it's a self-tape. Really recent development. I was talking about it only yesterday with another actor. I was like, actually, that's clearly. Like kids' open evenings, they're all online now. They're not going back.
I quite like that.
I do quite like it, but sometimes I'm like, I really want to talk to you directly. But
I know.
And that funny little 5 minute window that you
get.
Yeah,
you get that. Yeah. Yes.
But self-tapes do seem to be the thing now. And I very much do go.
You still have to do them.
Still do that.
So when you do them, is there a different, do you think there's a different expectation now?
Yes and no. So some work that I think I can sense that they've come and asked for me. And then other stuff, like I went up for something the other day that was like, I don't doubt that I was one of many hundreds that were going up for that part in that film. And, you know, it was a crap shot. And I don't think me being in Afterlife made any difference whatsoever.
You said it. Shush.
Oh.
Don't mention.
It's very hard to not mention it in the context of my CV. But
well, we can go there, but maybe not yet. But it's funny because I was just wondering about how people perceive you. So, and I think perception, I wonder if it happens when you're going up for work, because I know, because I've been doing it so long now, 35 years, that people perceive me as whatever.
Yeah.
But I think the perception of you has changed because of now the different things that people see you doing from the stand-up, from the unmentionable. So trigger point, that people now... Their perception of you has changed.
Which is lovely because it does mean you get more choices. That's the very lovely thing. Because when you're one thing, you're only up for one thing. Like when I first left college, I was a young drama graduate. I didn't do comedy then. And possibly having a slightly more working class accent rather than an RP accent, it just meant that I went up for lots of the same kind of parts on lots of the same kind of shows. And all you ever really want is just options, isn't it? And choices and be able to do lots of different types of things. And as I've found, as I've had more options, I get to play way more interesting parts. So now, like, I'll play an MP or a barrister in Adult Material, or a data analyst in Trigger Point, or... A private detective in Whitstable Pearl. And it's like, I didn't get those sort of choices when I first left college. It was like nurses and five lines as a nurse in Casualty. It's just lovely having all these different options now.
Trigger Point is coming back, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Have you started filming?
No, all I know is we're going to be doing it next spring. So I assume they're just writing it.
And that did fantastically
Amazing.
Well.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that, again, then, twisted the way people see you?
I think so.
The way it sort of put the unmentionable slightly.
I just think once you pop up in a few different things, it just means that people go, oh, she was in that and now she's in that. That's all it is. It's just a lovely, you know it when you've watched people's careers suddenly go bomp, 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 and they go, you just spot them in different things. And that's means you think of them in a different way.
So how do your family see it now? Are you to your kids, to Frank, you're just mum?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
Kids. Yeah, they're funny, aren't they?
Are they aware?
Yeah, they're aware. But my daughter's like into acting and drama and stuff like that. Also, she's a teenager, so she's too cool for school. She doesn't sort of react particularly. I think it's odd for them. I think the whole thing is a bit
it is odd
for them.
It is.
Yeah, I think it must be a bit strange.
Would you embrace her saying that she wants to do it?
I think we're already there.
Were you at NYT?
No, I didn't. I just did local youth theatre. Right. But she does want to do it. And I do have mixed feelings about it.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I sort of think, oh, God, you know, there's lots of upset and rejection and heartache and all those things. But I think it's silly to stop them because that is what she wants to do. And it gave me a lovely life. I met my husband through, we did a play together. You know, it's given me the life I've got. So it would be absurd to sort of stop her from trying. On a very basic level, you just want them to be happy. And if it makes them happy, then they have
absolutely
to go for it.
So your husband, so how is he about...
He's been brilliant.
So he is.
I couldn't do it if he hadn't supported me. I mean, I was starting out as a comic when he and I met. And he came to a really early gig and he said, you need to do that. You should do that. Like, there's something there. Because early gigs are just pretty much awful. It's like public therapy.
I can't imagine that you ever were.
They're kind of odd things because you're just looking for a sort of kernel of something that works, that you can build on. And he just recognised that there was a future. He was like, it's clearly something you should be doing. And for a few years, you know, I was free to do whatever I wanted. But once we started a family, it does then become quite challenging. And I think even when I started, there was still far fewer women doing it. Now it's way better, like we were just saying about panel shows. But there was still a situation whereupon I'd go to a gig and other people would go, who's looking after the kids? And you're like, their dad. You know, so those sort of questions...
They never ask men how they juggle. I hate that expression.
No, exactly. How do you do it? But the truth of that is that I probably couldn't have done it without him, you know, and his sort of unwavering support, really.
And do you try things out on him?
Subliminally, not in a kind of sit there, listen to me. I might do that awful thing that comics sometimes do, which is they sort of drop ideas into an exchange and see if it makes him laugh. I still love making him laugh. So it is a kind of, sometimes it falls short because I'll make him laugh and try it on stage and it will crash and it'll be like, oh, made Ben laugh.
So how does it feel if it does crash, if somebody doesn't laugh at that thing?
It's horrible.
Yeah.
But you
see,
just move on.
That's a bit I don't...
Yeah, of course, it's mortifying, but you just move on. You style it out. I've become very good at styling things out.
I can't imagine anybody not laughing. So your tour then, obviously because of coronavirus and everything, that everything for stand-up, that was...
All put on hold. Yeah, it was all put on
so
hold.
So how, the tour now, you're doing stuff again, aren't you?
You're
back out there.
So I finally got all those dates in and we did them and they went really well and I really enjoyed it. And when it came to an end, finally, I sort of played the last of those. I mean, there was one that was like right at the end of the end because when I was supposed to do it, I got COVID. So I had to cancel that one and put that one right back. And so I finally did the last of all of the dates that had been previously in pre-pandemic. And I wasn't ready to stop doing that show. So I sort of asked my agent if we could just put another block in, which is what we're doing for this autumn. And I'm really glad because I still really like that show. And it has had a funny journey. When you write something pre-pandemic, then you tweak it to sort of like the emergence of us all out of those lockdowns. Now I think that's starting to feel a bit like it's sort of we're distancing ourselves from that kind of episode.
Yeah.
So now I can sort of tweak it again to fit.
So when you finish that, other comics, I always ask this, but when you put one to bed and you then start building
it's
on
a horrible
another,
transition. Yes. It's the worst part of it because when you've done a whole hour and you've got it really nice and slick, you just can't imagine ever being able to do it again. But don't novelists feel like that when they write a book and then they can't imagine writing another one? I mean, it does feel like
I can't imagine
doing it all again and going back to the foothills and being
shit
again.
But you will,
and just starting from the beginning with ideas and going, is this funny? Is this funny? Do you think this is funny? But you just have to, I suppose.
You
That's
will,
part of
won't
the job.
You? You're not going
to
stop.
Yeah, I don't know. I assume not. Oh. No. Well, no. But I don't have a plan. I've never had a grand plan. It's all been... You know, I don't plan anything really much more than 5 or 6 months ahead.
Really? You've
Not
never
really.
Done that?
No, but I suppose now having done it for as long as I've done it, there's a pattern that I can see with retrospect and go, oh, yeah, you do a new hour every few years. So you probably will keep that up.
So, right.
Because back in the day, I'd do Edinburgh. So it would be Edinburgh that would mark those transitions.
Those, yes.
But now I don't really do Edinburgh anymore. So it has to be self, I was going to say inflicted, but that sounds slightly more.
Yeah. But
violent.
It is actually. It is self-inflicted. Yes.
But it is. So at some point, I and my agent will go, shall we start maybe working on a new show?
Wow. Okay.
And she's brilliant. And she'll be the one that'll go, let's put some new material nights in. Let's work towards a new tour. And she will give me that kind of nudge and that confidence impetus. To just come on, build it up.
But you've got trigger point and you've got other stuff as well that sort of will take up that time. But you might, I presume,
you're always bubbling away.
Itchy feet.
Yeah, there's always a sort of little voice at the back. It used to be a notebook, but now it's the smartphone and you just put the odd thing in. And once you've got enough of them, you go, oh, I could get a routine out of that, maybe.
Oh, see, I love that.
Yeah. That is the creative side of it. That's why I quite like Twitter. I've never kind of thrown it in. Like, I have love-hate relationship, as we all do, with social media. But actually, the side of it that I quite like is jokes. That you can try a joke out on Twitter, or not even a joke, but just an observation, and sort of get a sense of whether it's got resonance or a bit of a, like, connection. If people respond to it in an interesting way, you go, oh, there's a routine there. There's something I can do with that.
What makes you laugh?
Oh, God, loads of things make me laugh.
Like what?
Well, other comics and my friends and family life. And
so which comics? Who makes you laugh?
Oh, God, loads of them. I mean, that's the part of my job I love the most, is that I can watch comedy all the time. Like I just said, we was Latitude this summer and spent most of the time in the comedy tent because my kids wanted to.
Oh, how lovely.
And just really enjoyed just watching stand-up, just really enjoying stand-up.
So and that you have this amazing community.
Yeah, I do like that side of it.
And you're all very supportive of one another.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel competitive at all. No. And that's very rare when you get a bunch of performers together. You're sometimes, you know, we've seen those elbows.
Yeah.
You and I have seen people with those elbows who do that and they sort of go, no, I want that. But with the comedy community, you feel that you all support one another.
That has been my experience, definitely. I mean, I think you're right about the old elbows out. And I've, you know, we've all witnessed a bit of that now and then. But in the main, I do genuinely feel like it's a very supportive community, without a doubt.
Okay, so let's mention the unmentionable because if I often walk past him in the park and I...
Do you?
I might just stick my tongue out and go, you know what? We didn't talk about you. Okay, so let's talk about Afterlife. It was a phenomenon. I presume you didn't think... You had no idea how it was going to end up being so huge throughout the world. The world.
No, and because I'd done Derek already, I'd already worked with Ricky on another project, so it felt like a nice continuation of a relationship.
Just a follow-on from the past.
Yeah, and I wasn't 100% sure when he first mentioned it. It was like quite, at that stage, still early days, so it was quite vague. And he was like, I'm like this thing. Do you want to play my dead wife? And I didn't quite know what that meant. But obviously now I realise, you know, the size of it. But that couldn't have been known at the beginning by anyone, including him. It's just blown up.
I think it was just so nice to see something that made everybody think. And actually, comedy can really do that. See, I've left it. We've done it. We've talked about Afterlife.
Good comedy should do that. But you know. And now we're living, I think things change and evolve. And the Americans have always been really good at those kind of hybrid comedy drama things. They've always put drama.
Yes.
And we always used to do comedy, and it's comedy, and it's half an hour, and it's six episodes of half an hour, and you've got to have a high gag rate, and it's not sad, and there's nothing else going on. And now I don't think we're in that place anymore. And most good comedies now have got a narrative and a drama, and things like Fleabag or I May Destroy You. That's like extreme drama next to proper high comedy with jokes, you know.
But it never, the thing about Afterlife, and actually, and the other ones you just mentioned, you never feel guilty about having that laugh. And I think that is that's a very, very fine line. That those comedies that make you think, the stand-ups, those, you know, that people do, that you do, that make you think, that but don't make you feel guilty for laughing at something that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And that's such a fine line. And it's a beautiful fine line.
Yeah. Well, it's humanity, isn't it? You're just sort of distilling.
Lots of people say, though, that actually going back to where we started about you shouldn't make jokes about X and Y. And these days, I do feel it's possibly tougher. Mm. I loathed it in the day when people felt it was free rein to be racist and anti-Semitic and... homophobic and all of that. I loathed that. I don't find humour in that at all. But I feel that you have to be more careful now over little things. Things that might make you laugh, but you know you can't take it out there. Other comics have said you do have to sometimes self-check.
Yeah. And it is a, I mean, it does seem to be an ongoing transition, cultural transition at the moment. But no one who's been cancelled as such, I don't know. I don't witness that many people being cancelled that haven't done or said something that, you know,
yeah,
isn't okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you, who's going to accidentally be racist or accidentally be misogynistic? It's like, I don't know.
I don't mean those.
It's a really difficult subject.
I think there are the other subjects that people, it's like people, obviously, after the death of the Queen, there was a lot of people saying, this you don't make fun of. Of course you don't make fun of it, but how do you cope with that when you're a comedian? Something that the world is in mourning for. How do you cope with these things as a comedian? It's a very fine line.
But satire has always had a function in the world of comedy, and people subverting what's okay and what's not okay. And like I just said, saying, you know, literally the thing that shouldn't be said is sort of the job of the jester, you know, in the court. Yes. It is difficult to find that what's okay and what's not okay. And everyone's moral compass at the moment seems to be in very different places. But it's not a comic's job or a comedian's job to seek to offend. It's just to say, I mean, I always think I think the territory that I sort of use for my comedy is emotions and feelings and hypocrisies and these sort of things. You're sort of slightly poking a stick at our underbelly and our sort of vulnerable side or whatever. And that hypocrisy is funny. I find it funny. And we have so many hypocrisies in our social norms, you know, that we're learning on a very steep slope at the moment that we're all culpable of hypocrisy and we have conflicting opinions and we can hold two truths. And this culture war is forcing us into these sort of polarities that they're not part of who we are. You know, I can be a Republican or not. I don't massively agree with the royal family as a concept or the monarchy, but I feel sad that the Queen died.
Yeah.
And I can have those two truths in my, you know, canon, and I can do that and talk about that and express that. And that can be funny. I can find humour in it.
That's why you have, I'm going back to how I started, that you have funny bones. I think you're one of those people that is a rare thing that you can walk down the street. And this is a weird thing to say. Okay, please take this in the right way. That I know that if I was to see you walking down the street, I would laugh. Not because of the way you walk.
Well, that's nice, because at the moment when I walk down the street, people want to hold me and go, she's alive. they cry around me. So I'm like, no,
really?
Oh, I have a lot of that, yeah. It was really weird at Glastonbury Festival, because I suppose that's a high concentration of humans in one location. So my friend that I was with and my brother just found it hilarious that so many people would come up to me and go, oh, it's you. And just,
no, really?
Yeah, it was really odd. It was really
people.
Bizarre.
So people can't tell the difference.
Well, they just suddenly, I suppose the nature of that character and the way that that story is told is that I sort of, you know, I'm shown in videos and retrospectively and blah, blah, blah. There's something visceral about when they see me. It's sort of because they've cried with that show. And it's just a visceral reaction. And they're like, oh, it's you. Can I give you a hug? It's a strange thing.
But maybe also because you're Kerry Godleman stand up, so we know you by name. When you're an actress, you're those characters. But in that, they know you because of your stand up, but they know you because of that character. I'm just trying to.
I know, it's funny.
You walk both of those lines.
I'm only realizing that more so recently. Yeah, that it's kind of, because often if people stop me, I always assume it's afterlife. And then more often than I predict, it's Taskmaster. People will be like, Taskmaster, Bosch. And they love it.
So it's afterlife first, Taskmaster second.
Yeah, and then occasionally all kinds of things like Save Me or Trigger Point or other bits and pieces that I've done over the last few years. And that's lovely. That's really nice when it's.
I love the idea of everyone watching. See, I would just laugh. That's not really rude, looking at somebody going, you just make me laugh.
That's my job. And also, you've been watching loads of stand up lately.
Yeah, but no, but I did before when you were on. So it wasn't just for this.
Yeah.
I have always, I think when I interviewed you on the radio, and it was whenever it was, and I think it was about Trigger Point, but I just honestly, I put down the phone and I was giggling to myself thinking, you make me laugh.
Well, what really worries me sometimes, and I shouldn't let it, is that if that is when I'm doing a show like Trigger Point or Adult Material, which was like, you know, heavy.
Adult Material was superb.
And my character, what I love about that character.
Didn't make me laugh in that, don't worry.
Well, but that's what I mean is you panic and go, oh, I hope I don't evoke sort of that sort of response when I'm playing.
No,
but that is an interesting dilemma for a comedian to be able to be cast in serious drama. So I'm really glad that I have been able to get cast in some serious drama and not tipped over into, oh, now
she just
can't
does
do that. Because you just laugh, you know. Although I did a thing called Treadstone, which was like this American.
You've got your head in your hands. Why?
Because I do.
You're blushing.
Because I had played an American character, and I'm not 100% sure my accent was like rock solid. And occasionally, sometimes people will find me on Twitter and go, you turned up in that thing. And I just was like, what's she doing in that? Because it was a tiny bit incongruous with my casting and my persona.
I'm so sorry. I haven't seen it.
Well,
so
I'm really glad you haven't, because I've got a slight feeling that it would make you laugh, and it shouldn't.
Oh, really?
It didn't make you
laugh. Well, what was the character?
Well, she was a kind of spooky, kind of double agent-y. Oh, it's hard to explain, but it's just interesting that in that particular bit of casting, I just thought, oh, I might be pushing people's disbelief.
Right,
too
okay,
much
you do know what we're all going to do now.
Go and have a look.
Go and have a look.
Oh, yeah, maybe she's right. Just like, what? That doesn't fit somehow. But then, you know.
I love that. And I love, carry on doing what you do. Carry on doing everything across the board. And congratulations on all of it. And what's to come, because there's so much to come. I hope you feel that. Do you feel that?
Well, it is, like I was saying earlier, it's a nice position to sort of finally feel like there might be some choice, like that you can go, oh, shall I do that?
Wonderful.
And so much of this profession, you know, is quite challenging. It is quite hard. And sometimes you don't have the privilege of choices. You just take the work and do what you have to do. So it's nice to kind of go, oh, I can choose things. And that's lovely.
Thank you so much for being on this.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. And coming up next week, the delightful Emily Sunday. She talks about her life, her career, and working with the incredible Nile Rodgers. That Gabby Roslin podcast is proudly presented to you by Cameo Productions, with music by Beth Macari. If you wouldn't mind, could you give us a like, a follow, a subscribe, and please leave a review? We read them all and love to see what you've got to say. See you next week.